eyes, look up and see. All you've done, the path you've come, the things that you've achieved. And when you're doubting,
sometimes you have to follow the music. And the music might take you away from what you know, and it might take you away from the comrades you've had for most of your life. But you go with it, because the music's more important than the commitments you make. And that's a tough statement.
It's a big statement.
It's a big statement, and you have to kind of own that. You're either in this for the music or you're not, you know? Because I learned how to play guitar when I was about 12, right? And pretty soon after that, I started learning loads of songs, and I realised very early on, I serve music. I serve this long line of tradition that is music and songs, and I serve it. It doesn't serve me. Music will only serve me as long as I serve it. Put that distance from your mind. And if I stop serving it and start getting into duty and what this should be or that should be because I've made these decisions, then all I'm doing is kind of shutting off the tap. And I'm at your side. The tap needs to stay open, and if you follow the inspiration, it'll continue to be a value in your life and continue to be a reciprocal thing in your life. I've been mining down a dark hole. I've been mining
in the rocks for a heart of gold. I can't. I've been mining down a dark hole. I've been mining in the rock. I've been working for your wonder. I'm Éireann Ollinard, and this is Vocal Chords, an exploration of the human voice in song. And my guest today is a modern troubadour, a singer with a guitar slung over his shoulder in the tradition of Woody Guthrie or Bob Dylan. Glen Hansard's road began as a young teenager busking on the streets of Dublin, but it has taken him to some of the biggest arenas in the world and an Academy Award for Best Song. We met him first through the movie The Commitments, filmed back in his hometown of Ballymun, and his band The Frames. But since then, he has shared a stage with giants like Dylan, Leonard Cohen, and Bruce Springsteen. And he has created a body of work that maps the joy and sorrows of life. His songmaking has given him a platform to not just make great music, but to be a champion for the voiceless. I've been mining hard and
low, but I won't give up. I'm gonna fill my cup. Now my work has just begun.
This is rolling anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
Glen, if you could just read the poem. You have a poem.
Shall I just start?
Start away.
Okay.
All you've done, the path you've come, the things that you've achieved.
Well, this is a poem by Moya Cannon called Carrying the Songs. It was always those with little else to carry who carried the songs. To Babylon, to the Mississippi, some of these last possessed less than nothing, did not even own their own bodies. Yet 3 centuries later, deep rhythms from Africa, stowed in their hearts, their bones, carry the world's songs. For those who left my country, girls from the Downings and the Rosses, who followed the herring boats north to Shetland, gutting the sea silver as they went, or boys from Ranafast who took the Derry boat or slept over a rope in a bothy. Songs were their soul's currency, the pure metal of their hearts, to be exchanged for other gold, other songs which rang out true and bright when flung down on the deal boards of their days. It really has something, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, there's a sense of pilgrimage.
And there's also a sense of classlessness. And that was, I suppose, for me, the first thing that struck me about the choice I had made instinctively as a kid. In my house, there was always songs, but the songs were always related to drink. My dad had arrived back at 2 a.m. with half the pub, and the house would be raised and we'd be put on duty frying eggs, and suddenly there'd be a massive sing song and we'd go till the morning. But those were the kind of golden memories for me. And I must have been quite young, because the perspective I remember was kind of sitting under the table, looking at all the legs and listening to the voices. I remember my mother quite early on teaching me a couple of songs. I remember Ben by Michael Jackson. Ben, the two of us need look no more. And she'd have me sing that in the dead of night, you know, like everyone locked. You'd get the hush, 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 hush. And I realised very young that if you sing a song, you're standing equal with everybody. You're not the young fella who should be in bed. You're now the singer.
of the guys that might come home tumbling in there, what songs did you hear from under the table, do you recall? What kind of singing was that?
I had an uncle and he would always sing Leonard Cohen songs. And then for my fifth birthday, my mother taught me Bird on a Wire. And I remember sitting on the side of the sink and she had the fold-out record player, you know. And I remember as a kid, because I always loved, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I always loved that lyric. Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I've tried in my way to be free.
Like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.
And it's funny, only now, years and years later, you know, the song kind of revealed itself in a whole other way. Because when you're a kid, you're learning it phonetically, you're just learning the sounds.
I have saved all my ribbons for thee.
But it's amazing how a song will keep giving as you get older.
If I have been
were you thinking, even before you did start singing on the streets, that you would be able to do something like that on your own?
Well, I mean, I was really into Dylan at the time and really into early Dylan. So, and Dylan was coming from that Woody Guthrie world. And in a way, I kind of got this sense that maybe check out Woody.
Hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song.
And then you realise that we had our versions of that. We had Lou Kelly. Lou Kelly was like our Woody.
Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn.
And the other thing about being a musician is that you have the luxury of seeing time beyond the linear. Time folds, and so all of these characters and these heroes and these poets through the ages are suddenly present. You're walking beside them, you're not walking 50 years, you know.
You can almost feel them.
They're in the air, yeah.
I'm singing you this song, but I can't sing enough. 'Cause there's not many men who've done the things that you've done.
I just obsessed, and he became the focus of my whole life. And I'm not just talking about his music. You know, I kind of wanted to dress like him and think like him. He just became the thing I obsessed on for a long time. And so when I went out onto the street, I was armed with, you know, probably 150 of his songs in my canon.
You ain't a-going nowhere. Oh, we ride me high. Tomorrow's the day that my brides are gonna come. Oh, we are we gonna fly down into the easy chair.
And for me, the great journey as a young man was when I was 13, was heading over to Grafton Street to start my musical career.
Genghis Khan and his brother Don couldn't keep.
How much of a step was that? You've said before many times that it was a rather different place to go from where you were coming from. Can you just paint that picture?
Well, it was a little bit like going to America or something. I mean, it was a different Ireland, you know. Not to say that I grew up very class aware. I didn't at all. I grew up in Ballymun. I had no idea that Ballymun was a rough place. I had no idea that, you know, it had a reputation until I went to the south side. And then I realised, oh, I was from somewhere kind of a bit intense. But it never struck me that there was any difference between us and anyone else until I saw the other perspective. And when I saw it, I didn't become necessarily more class aware. I just was like, well, I'm not having that. I'll play music, and I'll play music with him, and I'll play music with him. And I kind of consciously decided then, rather than to make that a something that defined me, I made it something that absolutely didn't define me.
Maybe transcend that in some
ways. In a way, and how do you do that? You do that through learning, you do that through doing your thing and figuring out what it is you do and try to do it at the highest level you can do it, which is just to learn more songs.
You've got a unique a form of career guidance in your school, which was one of the deciding factors for you to go to Grafton Street and do your singing.
Yeah, I was given advice and I was also given a free pass. I mean, I was I wasn't doing well in school, you know, and I was very distracted as a kid. I was all over the place. And I was also headed for a life of trouble. I mean, I was a messer, like, I was beginning to do things I'm not proud of now, you know, the age where, you know, you naturally start drinking, you naturally start kind of pushing the boundaries a bit. And then the music. It just pulled me into a place where suddenly I was completely alone.
I stepped in the middle of seven sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans.
And all my mates didn't understand. Did nothing against it. Just, Glenn's off playing his guitar, fair enough. And I spent 2 years in my bedroom. Didn't leave. I just locked myself in.
It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
And my headmaster in Ballymun Comp called me down to the office one day and he said, Glenn, you have a brain. But he says, you're wasting it here. And he says, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be a musician. Like you. I said, I want to be like Bob Dylan. And he basically just sort of put it on the line. He said, why don't you start your career today? Why don't you go out, get your guitar, go into the street, start playing. And he said, I'm not going to promise you you'll be a rock star one day because I don't know the answer to that. But I promise you you'll have a life in music if you start now.
Did he know something you didn't know?
I have no idea. And you know what? Frankie still comes to my gigs.
This man?
Frankie Byrne, yeah, my old headmaster.
When he said that to you, mm-hmm. Did it confuse you?
No, it was like being told you'd won the lottery. That was exactly the language I needed to hear. I left the school. I went and got my school bag out of the class.
It sounds like the Great Escape.
Yeah, I walked home and took the guitar. I went into town.
Do you ain't gone nowhere, so you're not right.
Yeah?
Hiya.
Actually, the first coin that was dropped into my bag, I closed up and left, and I went and I bought a cup of tea, and that, it was the best cup of tea I ever drank, because I had earned it out of music. And it was like, this was a profound moment for me as a young fly. I was like, that's it. You know, and Frankie had been right. That was the beginning of something.
You paid your way.
I paid my way, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But it was something about making that step. Taking the guitar out of the guitar case for the first time was a declaration. And that was a massive step forward. That moment of courage, because it's really a moment. Because once you've taken the guitar out of the case for the second time, it's less terrifying. And I was learning so quickly. And it was then that I realized if you can make your voice hit the building opposite and you hear it back, then you're filling the street. And I never learned how to sing quietly after that. Do you know what I mean?
Does anybody ever have to tell you to chill?
Yeah, I mean, if I sing you a song in a room and I still have that instinct of like, throw it out.
Kind of almost like casting it out, maybe.
Casting it out, there you go. Well, that's now, that would be the more refined version. I think I lob it out.
That's what.
So swift, the rain's pouring in. We're gonna see a movie called Gone Get In. Pack up your money, put up.
I'm curious as well, you're listening to Dylan and Leonard Cohen and all these, you call them heroes, and that is what surely they are. This is going on inside your head too. All their music, all their words, all their concepts, their image, their sense of themselves. Were these people like guiding stars for you?
100%. I mean, they were the gods. They were the stars. They were the place to navigate to. And if you imagine, as a young person, your spirit is kind of wide open. And what happened to me was, within that year, that first year of playing music, I set every sail in my spirit, my soul, my person. I set every sail in one direction. And every little gust of wind that came in that direction brought me forward. And everything else was ignored.
Thank you.
So it was only a matter of incrementally moving towards this life you had chosen. And there was nothing, my mother used to say, God, but I worry about you, you know, you're, no, I know that this is where I'm going. And it's either this or I'll die. You know, I'm not giving this up.
This situation's killing me. It's got me right under the phone. I don't know where I wanna be.
And the direction was Bob, actually. Not to say that I wanted to write as well as him. It was just he seemed to embody this that mystery. Whatever that thing is, that energy that we're all so attracted to.
From my time you told me. You see, I want my life to make more sense. I want my life to make amends. I want my life to make more sense to me.
And one of the other great sort of moments was at 22, still playing a bit on Grafton Street, I walked into Bob Dylan on Grafton Street.
Like, physically?
I was walking along and I saw a man in the doorway and I knew the fingers and I knew the nose and I knew that. So there he was.
So what happened? You bumped into him?
I bumped into him and I said hello to him and I had a copy, actually happened to have a copy of Tarantula, his book, in my pocket. And he said hello, he took the book, he signed it, he handed it to me and he walked in and said nothing. And I was just like, I was stunned. But then, about 4 days later, I met Bob again. Now, this is where it gets all a bit spooky. Because, you know, if you're setting your sail towards someone and then suddenly you bump into them twice in a week, it's kind of crazy. But I met him in the rehearsal room, in the factory. We were rehearsing in the factory, the band. And we're playing through some songs, and myself and Cullum and Noreen and Dave Odlin were in the room working something out. And Bob appeared at the doorway of the rehearsal room. And I looked around and he goes, sounds good. And we were like, I walked up to him again. I said, Bob, I met you the other night. And meeting you is what it must have been like when you met Woody. And he said, oh, Woody, man. Woody was amazing. I sang for him a couple of times. And then he just goes into this story about Woody Guthrie. And I'm just like, oh my God, I'm talking to Bob Dylan. And we talked for, you know, maybe a minute. Not about Bob, not about the gigs, not about Anton, just about Woody. And he left. And I was like, fucking hell, what is going on? This is, you've just completed a complete circle there. And the next day, there was a phone call to the rehearsal room saying, someone wants to talk to you, to Glenn, on the singer from the Frames. And it was Bob Dylan's manager, Jeff Kramer. And he said, I don't know what you said to Bob, I don't know what happened, but he wants you to come over to London tonight. Can you come?
Did I see you this morning? Were you down at
the... He said, if you can get a flight to London, you can open for us at the Apollo.
The band?
Yeah. So we found a flight that was probably 91, 92. And we went over to London and got on. We went on stage and I told the story on stage, you know, because I'm completely freaked out.
If I see you this evening, and I still seem far away. Are they just thinking of her?
One song called 15 C4 Parade, that was a song I do remember playing. And I was really aware of the fact that he was there, like he was at the side of the stage. The hood was up, he was watching us.
Yeah, I'm wishing I'd stay. 15 C4 Parade.
And you've maintained this beautiful relationship with him since then.
So from meeting him that day and doing the gig with him, we've done gigs with him through the years every so often and kept contact with him. And when we won the Oscar, got a message from him just saying, like, I've known you a long time. Congratulations, you know.
How beautiful is that?
Oh, it's amazing.
Early one morning the sun was shining. She was lying in bed.
But my relationship with Bob Dylan remains the same now as it was when I was 12. It's just, there's so much admiration for the mastery of the work. I mean, I'm not as fanatical as an older man. It would be a little odd if I was. But I am still 100% committed to the love of what he's given me through the years.
Getting through, tangled up in blue.
I've heard you say some really beautiful things about another great artist that you've admired, Leonard Cohen, that there's a sort of a prayerfulness to his singing and his songwriting, and that it's always something that's had a huge impact on you.
Yeah. I actually went to the gig in 1985. Cohen was playing, he was touring various positions, and my cousin, who had just been hit by a car a few months previous and was suffering really bad epilepsy as a result of the accident, was a huge fan and had bought me a ticket. I was really excited, blown away to be going to the gig.
Thank you so much, friends.
Leonard was playing the stadium, and he was playing two concerts in one day. So we were going to the early show, 5 to 7 or whatever it was, and then he was going back on at 8 to 10. And Leonard came on, and maybe 5 or 6 songs into the set, he played Famous Flamenco.
It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I write you now just to see if you're any better.
And during Famous Flamenco, my cousin took a fit, and Leonard was like, is that boy okay? But my God, he noticed us. And so we get him out to the side, and he's kind of calmed down a bit. And a guy with a pass on came out and said, look, if he's all right, bring him back to the later show. And went to see the next gig, except they put us in the box. And so we're sitting in the box and watching the gig from the... We're feeling brilliant. And, you know, the gig was amazing. So we got to see it kind of twice. But then after the gig, the guy with the pass said, hang on a second, just wait here for a minute. The crowd all filed out. And, you know, we were watching the band take... Watching the crew taking the gear down. We were so fascinated by the whole... the mechanics of this world, you know. And then Leonard came up and he came into the box and he said, are you okay? And shook my cousin's hand and then shook my hand. And I remember at the time, 15, I remember going, feeling this like transformation of like, this is my life. This is what I'm doing. Then, over 30 years later, I went and I sang for Leonard at an event in Spain where I performed Famous Flamenco.
It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better.
Had you had some linkage with him in the preceding years, or was that just an invitation based on your reputation at that point?
It was an invitation that came through Javier Mas, his guitar player, and he had played on one of my records.
Oh, the last time I saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station.
And afterwards, I got to tell Leonard the story about meeting him when I was 15. And, you know, he was very, very beautiful. He was very calm and he was very quiet. And we all went to a little bar near the venue and we drank some drinks and we talked about Lorca because Lorca's niece was there. And we spoke about the poet a little bit. And again, it's a bit like the meeting with Dylan. As long as you're not talking about Leonard, we're in good shape. Because, you know, how much has Leonard Cohen heard? You've helped me out, you've saved my life, you've been it.
And in some ways, I suppose, to be fair to you, he sees you as one of his own kind. You're in the tower as well.
Well, I mean, you know, as Leonard very well points out, Hank Williams is 200 floors above him. I can't imagine how many floors Leonard Cohen is above me.
But nevertheless, it was a pinch myself moment, I'm sure.
100%, and that's, you know, the thing is, you give yourself over to a life. It's not about being famous and earning a load of money and earning the right to be this or that. It's about living a life. And I signed up when I was a kid. I had nothing. I came into this world with a curiosity about this idea of songs. And I've been very, very fortunate that I've got to meet the people that I consider the greats. And you just get to have this moment where you shake the hand and you say, thank you. And I promise you, the best way I'll honor your work is by doing mine.
And what can I tell you, my brother, my killer? What can I possibly say? I guess that I miss you. I guess I forgive you.
How much of an influence or an inspiration has Van been to you?
I mean, for me, Van has probably been the most influence in a way, because when you play a Van song, it's not cerebral, it's pure heart.
Laying it down. Silence is to be born again.
And I feel for me personally, that's where I am more naturally attuned.
Would you kiss a man? Down.
For me, the Collins and the Dylans, they're very intellectual. But Van just has this pure, you know, his songs cut through like a sword.
On the bright side of the ocean, that I put the wheels in motion, and I'm standing with my arms behind me.
Van Morrison has his place in the world. Bob Dylan has his place in the world. Cohen has his place. Joni Mitchell has her place. Kate Bush has her place. My place is not to be any of those people. Whatever it is I'm here to do, is it's not about emulating Dylan or Cohen or Joni Mitchell. It's not at all, or Van. It's about being who I am. And all those things can influence me and be have a strong influence on me. And sometimes they can be intimidating, and sometimes they can crush me because of their brilliance. But it's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to do what I do. And my job is to find out what that is.
There'll be no more running around for me. No more going down. You see, the line is drawn, my enemy. Better stay behind it. There'll be no more lifting half the way. My will is strong, my back is straight. Whatever lies you told to me, I'll see through them. Now I found song, grace beneath the judge's gavel. Grace among my brothers on the firing line. Grace upon this road less traveled. Grace beneath the pines, the pines. Grace beneath the pines.
And people would say, sometimes they would say, Glenn Hansard has a very unusual relationship, for example, with filmography. Like an accidental actor in some ways.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour.
And yet it has had an impact on maybe the choices you can make. Would that be true, that it has helped?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, The Commitments was a hugely pivotal moment in my early life. And it was a moment also where I realised what celebrity is and how kind of shallow and unreliable it is. The other thing that was really exciting was learning all those songs. Suddenly I was learning 20, 30 songs that were completely outside of my canon, soul music. And we got to tour with Wilson Pickett.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour.
You know, and so I'm standing in a rehearsal room with Wilson Pickett. And he's looking at me going, oh man, you're playing too white. You gotta hang on the beat. And I'm like, okay, right. And he's like, how to show me? He was really giving the band a hard time, but it really made us a better band. It was powerful. We traveled to America, brought me folks with me. So that whole chapter for me was just brilliant. But there was something in me that went, that was going, this isn't going to last.
You were watching what was coming next.
Kind of watching it. And of course, we were all flown back to Dublin and there wasn't a car to pick us up. We were used to, you know, cars picking us to bring us across the street. And suddenly we were back in Dublin. I remember Johnny Murphy saying, ah, now, there you go, lads. That's it, we're back now, down to earth, it's over now. And I looked around me and I saw my friends, these people that I'd kind of grown very close to over the last year. I watched them all at some point kind of go through a very, very difficult
sort of come down from
kind of a breakdown in a way.
How did you remain unaffected in that situation?
Well, I had a strange kind of a run-in with Alan Parker, which I think put me at odds with it in the middle of it. Because they had said to us, look, if there's something you've got to do, we need to know a week in advance so that we can reschedule. But what they were basically saying, and I didn't realise, was you're not taking any time off this. You've been given the opportunity of a lifetime. Don't you dare ask for a night off. But it just so happened that the very first Frames gig was in the Purty Loft on the 15th of July. I'll never forget the date because I had to ask for it all. And I remember they gave it to me. It was the night that we were supposed to be on the Dart, Destination Anywhere. I remember we were to shoot that thing.
I see a car can tumble down, and I know your future now. I see a car can tumble down, I watch the wheel go spinning round. I see a car can tumble down, and I know your future now. I watch the wheel.
And anyway, at the end of the film, when we were finished, I remember Parker saying to me, he said, you know, Glenn, in all of my films, there's one asshole, and I didn't think it would be you. And I was just, my jaw dropped. I was like, what? Like, I didn't deserve it at all. Anyway, so I kind of was like, this isn't my world.
It's his world.
It's his world. And you know what? It's Roddy Doyle's world. And Alan Parker has gone off and made a beautiful film, which I'm very proud of. But my thing is, was on the 15th of July.
When Once came along, did any of those sort of abilities to distance yourself from something, to kind of see it in perspective, did that help you again? I mean, did you even want to act?
I didn't want to do the film with John because I was afraid of kind of letting him down. And I just said to John, promise me one thing. If I'm terrible, you'll tell me, because I don't want to be in your film if I'm no good. And he said, I promise you I'll replace you if you're not any good. And afterwards, he said, you know, you weren't actually. You weren't that good. And neither of you were, because you weren't actors. And so what he ended up doing was John ended up editing most of the dialogue out of Once. And he said, so he's decided somewhere along the edit to just put songs in their full length in, because that made more sense. Well, from me and Mar, because it meant that our songs got these full
renditions.
Working out kind of really well for everyone, because John had the most successful film of his career.
The reaction, I mean,
it was amazing. We brought it to Galway because we tried to get into Sundance, and I think it had been rejected. And a guy from Sundance who would like the Frames, an American guy, was on holiday, came to the film flat, saw the film, and came up to me afterwards, said hello, and said, do you mind if I work for Sundance, do you mind if I pitch it to them? And we were like, yeah, pitch it to them, that'd be great. Not telling them that we'd already tried it. And so we brought it in, and we got into Sundance. And the film ended up winning the audience award.
And went on to win the Oscar.
We ended up winning the... Glenn, the Oscar.
And the Oscar goes to Glenn Hansard and Arkadiy Aglova for Falling Slowly for Months.
Gaurav Mila Mila Matagut. This is amazing. What are we doing here? This is mad. Make art. Make art. Yeah, thanks.
And myself and Marketa were touring all the way through all that period, and you know, the buzz in the audience was just amazing. I'd never experienced that like it. And that ended up becoming a whole chapter of my life, which then became the Swell season. And I had toured the year before with my friend Damien Rice and all over these amazing theatres in America. And I remember saying to Damien, Jesus, this is amazing. This is what I want. And the funny thing is, it's only when you know what you want that the universe will kind of start going click, 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 click. And the mechanics of that sort of desire start to manifest.
We drive away.
And so within 2 years of playing with Damien in those amazing rooms, myself and Marquette were playing those amazing rooms.
And half a soul.
Once is now 10 years ago, it was released. And we're still playing those theatres. And that was the incredible thing, was that Once was a proper step into a different level of touring, a different level of playing. When the Swell season broke up and myself and Marquette broke up and that period of our lives ended, it was only ever going to last as long as the relationship lasted.
You were burned out. Had to stop before all hell.
And so out of that came a moment where I was in New York and I found myself around new people. I was hanging out with Thomas a lot.
Thomas Bartlett.
And myself and Thomas had talked about making a record for years together. I went in, I started recording some songs, and before I knew it, I realized I had just recorded the record.
Echoes of another time, playing lightly on my mind.
But I didn't quite know what it was. Will I call it The Frames? Will I call it The Swell Season? Or will I call it Glenn Hansard? Because it is me after The Swell Season.
Temper the bitterness and love. And though what you say is true, this might be it for me and you.
So although I had never intended to kind of leave The Frames and go solo, it kind of happened by circumstantial steps, if you know what I mean.
Maybe another time.
And that was kind of a difficult transition for me, but it also freed me up to make music with other people.
Even if a day feels too long, feel like you can wait another one. And you're slowly giving.
Because it's very, very important in your creative life that you're willing to shed whole chapters of your life. Creatively, you have to be willing to say, I know we've been faithful to each other for all this time, but I'm going to go play music with these guys in New York because it excites me.
The harder decision in some ways, but a very creative avenue.
Creative for me. Yeah.
Tethered to a bird of sorrow, a voice that's buried in the hollow. You've given over to self-deceiving. You're prostrate, bowed, but not believing. You've squandered more than you could borrow. You've bet your joy on all tomorrows for the hope of some returning.
I read recently that in your last record, Didn't He Ramble? you had it practically ready, and then somebody told you that it wasn't ready. And you went back, you kind of stood in front of a mirror, as it were. And you're standing in front of a mirror as quite an experienced songwriter at this point. So what I'm reading into that is that it isn't that it got easier. In some ways, the step got higher.
Yeah. When I finished my last record and I had these songs and they were kind of in a shape and they were sounding good, but they weren't sounding true. And basically what someone said to me is, you can just go a little deeper there. And, you know, the best thing you can say about any singer is, I believe him when he sings. And that's the currency of what we do. And if someone comes along and says, I don't believe you, that's it. You know, you're doing something wrong.
That album, Didn't He Ramble, in a sense also is all the more difficult because of the subject matter. Because it's your father, your relationship to your father, your own definition to yourself of your father.
Absolutely. And my dad was a hard-working man. He was a drinker. He was a wild man. He was someone I kind of knew and someone I kind of didn't. But when I talk about my father, ironically, Bob comes into that. So does Leonard, because these were my father figures when I was a kid. And so in a way, when you're singing to your father, you're kind of singing to the one who raised you.
Now, by paradox, the title is a song that isn't on the record.
It was the song that I was feeling closest to about my dad. And, you know, Didn't He Ramble? I remember hearing that title and I was like, that's, there it is. And for me, there's a play on words, because my dad's local bar was called the Ramble Inn. And so Didn't He Ramble was like, yes, he rambled every day. And again, it comes into the whole lot of them. You know, Leonard traveled his whole life, Dylan traveled his whole life, and I'm traveling my whole life. And there's an aspect of he was with other women. And the word ramble sort of brings in this whole other connotation that he was kind of a free man, a bit of a gypsy.
You've actually sung this song, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah, and I recorded it.
You wouldn't be able to...
To play on the guitar.
Is there an arm that could be twisted?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Is so, there?
Yeah, right.
That would be fantastic.
Didn't he ramble? Didn't he roam?
fantastic.
It's kind of an incomplete song, but it just has a spirit. And that was kind of where I was happy to leave it, because there was all these other lyrics about shedding your father's clothes and about sort of leaving stuff behind. But every time I sang it, I thought, you know what? That's just getting too much into the nub of what it is. I know that, then that's enough.
And we've seen you on stage with some of your own heroes, and I was studying pretty closely your performance with Bruce Springsteen in Kilkenny.
Oh, yeah.
And what struck me about that was his countenance as you were singing his song. He was almost like looking at himself, looking at his song through you. And he had this beautiful, quiet, almost fatherly satisfaction that the song was breathing out through somebody else, someone he really trusted.
Well, tonight,
do you remember moments like that?
I remember that day very, very well, because that was one of those moments in life where you have to rise, get out of your own head here. And at one point, Bruce said, you know, towards the end of the song, you just go off into something there. You know, if there's an ad lib. And he said, don't worry about what's going to happen on stage. I will be very clear about when you come in, I come in.
Sharing verses and things, it was fairly intricate. There was a sort of a dance going on there.
But he directed me right through it, and he was really good, you know, because he's the leader. So you just get it, you get in line. And so at one point I started singing Van Morrison's Here Comes the Night. You know, and Bruce didn't know it. He was kind of like, oh, okay. And so there was a lovely playfulness as well. And I'm looking around at the band, and the drummer, Max Weinberg, was watching Bruce. And we both turned to Max at one point, and Max just watched Bruce.
Glued.
And afterwards, Max said to me, it sounded great. He said, I never take my eyes off Bruce, because I used to work in a strip bar in the 60s. He was talking about, he says, you never take your eyes off the money. That was his joke.
In the waiting for us down.
And of all of the people that I've met, Bruce, I suppose, was the most generous, in that I remember after we won the award, Bruce was playing in Dublin.
He's calling strangers, hear them crying.
And I remember someone coming out and saying, do you want to come back and say hello? Myself and Mara were like, wow, this is brilliant. We went back and he said, look, I'm about to go on and do the gig, but if you want to hang out later on and have a drink, and I'd love to, you know, love to chat with you and see where you're at.
When I lost you, honey, sometimes I think I lost my guts too.
So after the gig, we were brought back to the hotel he was staying in, and we sat up all night. I said, to be honest, if I can be really honest with you, it was a couple of months after the award, probably the summer, and I said, it's all this good news, and it's all this, there's something inside me doesn't trust it, and I'm kind of, I sort of feel like I'm really down.
In the heat of the night, like prisoners all our lives.
And this is what Bruce said. He said, you know what? You've been struggling your whole life, and suddenly you get some good news, but all you know how to do is struggle. So what do? You struggle with the good news. You're in a different place now. You're mourning the passing of some part of yourself that was always about the underdog. And he says, unfortunately, you're not that now. You'll have to deal with that. That's difficult. But, you know, you'll find yourself soon now being able to stand up and sing about this experience.
And dry your eyes. And come on, come on, come on, come
and
on.
And he kind of put things in such perspective for me. He was so brilliant.
To buy you some shoes and to taste your tender charm.
It seems pretty obvious to a lot of people that you're driven by conscience, issues of conscience. I mean, even recently, the Home Sweet Home campaign, you're front and center there. You're very exposed, willingly, to front a very public dispute or a set of arguments about how people should be treated in Ireland and how they're not treated in Ireland, etc. Is it your conscience that drives you to this?
At the dark.
Well, I mean, because every year we go busking, and every year we do some gigs. And I didn't design it this way. It just sort of worked out that in the last sort of 5 or 6 years, every time I play around Christmas, we give the money to something. You know, let's try to be actually helpful.
Living in darkness to hide our wrong. You and me at the dark end of the street. You and me.
And the Christmas busk is much more of a symbol than it is a moneymaker. But what it does is getting all the musicians that we know to come in on Christmas Eve and sing a few songs for a couple of hours on Grafton Street sets a consciousness in the country that's got to do it. You know what? I must donate this year.
But darling, our love will carry on, just steal away.
And I suppose last year, I found myself hanging out with friends and people who were like, wouldn't it be great to do something practical? Something that's actually, you know...
Measurable.
And of course, when you really look at the situation, you go to yourself, well, OK, there are many NGOs now in the homeless industry. But if the government was doing the job that the government are given charge to do, then there wouldn't be the charities. There would be equality. And of course, people will always make poor choices. And of course, no one gets to sort of solve the world's issues. But when the numbers of homelessness are going completely through the roof, it starts to get really odd. And so in a funny kind of a way, we're only now seeing the echoes of 2008, 2007, 2008. So is there something that we could do as a nation, as a people? And so we're like, well, there's an empty building. And in my naivety, I honestly thought, do you know what? The government will give us the building. We'll go into it. We'll take it over. And they'll go, you know what, lads, fair play to you. Get people off the street for the Christmas, you know, that's a good idea.
Your version of the GPO?
Not at all. For some people, it was that.
Do you think so?
For some people, it was definitely that. For some people, they saw it as a revolutionary act. I saw it as an act of civil disobedience in order to draw attention to an issue that we all know about. It was just about trying to help a few people stay out of the cold.
This land was your land. This land is mine.
For me, it was never anti-Fine Gael.
Yeah.
It was never anti-government. You know, I mean, I'm only anti-Fine Gael in so much as that they're not doing their job.
But for you, maybe it was personal rather than ideological.
It was personal. It was personal.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From Usher's
island. And I found myself with a bunch of great people. Some of them were quite extreme. And I kind of wasn't interested in that. And so Home Sweet Home was a kind of a gathering of different minds and different people. And others were doing it just because they're in the mode of just kicking against. And so you had all of these different elements come together under one idea. And it turns out I ended up being the guy on the late that night going, we did something.
And in terms of taking over a building, are you occupying it illegally as such?
Yeah.
OK. And then the authorities are going to come in and say,
And after we did it, I immediately felt like, oh, what the hell? What have I got myself involved in?
This building. What's the plan? What if they come knocking and say you can't be here? What do you say?
If anyone knows their stuff, they know that that's essentially our building. We're just going to take it for a few months.
But I was proud also of the fact that we had just kind of stood up and tried to do something decent. Would I be doing it again tomorrow? Not a chance. But I'm really glad I did.
Does that mean that you feel that the poet or the artist cannot just simply inject themselves into the public conversation?
I got a lot of flack on this because of the fact that, like, well, what would you know about the people? Okay, fair enough. You know, I go out and I work and I earn my money through my endeavour. Is the fact that I'm successful at my work mean that I've got less of a voice in my society? And so who do I speak for? I speak for myself. I refuse to live in a society where it's all just about the self. Because if it's all just about the self, where does that lead us? There has to be a time when you're willing to stand up and take the embarrassment and sort of go, well, look, I don't agree.
Shelter, shelter bell, ring out for all below. Keep your doorway open wide, give us somewhere to go. And when we're full of doubt, we don't know what about, oh, won't you tell us no? Shelter, shelter bell, ring out for all below.
You've known yourself also for supporting younger artists and for reaching out. Is there a duty to that? Is there an aspect to that that you feel is a natural calling, that we should give good counsel to people who are starting out on what is very can be a very difficult journey?
Well, I mean, I was very lucky. As a very young musician, I went out there, you know, with no guides in a way. And I very quickly met them. And of course you have to. That's your job. You've got to pass that on. If you didn't pass that on, it makes the initial gift irrelevant. And therefore you've somehow welched on your deal. And if you're not doing that, you've lost something.
Tired, tired eyes, look up and see.
And when fear starts getting in your way, then you just know that there's something not going good with yourself. And your job is to sort of go out there and shine a light on the good stuff, you know?
I'm gonna find that gold, now my work has just begun. Come on, pilgrim, won't you stay the road?
And this life isn't about me accruing wealth and accruing celebrity friends or becoming, you know, a character that is to be spoken of, or I forget all that's all a trap. All of that stuff is just gonna lead you into a world where you're lonely.
I've been mining down a dark hole. I've been mining in the rock.
Because then everything is, the value of everything is on how well you're regarded. Or, you know, forget all that. Just stick with your work. And when someone comes along who looks like they might be able to, you know, get a dig out from you, then give them a dig out and stop thinking about it.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank when you, you're really doubting, nice.
Thank you very much.
I hope you'll trust in me.
Irlo Leonard was speaking to the singer Glenn Hansard in that episode of Vocal Chords. The audio editor was Pierce O'Queeve and the producer was Helen Shaw. The programme is an Athena Media production for RTE Lyric FM.